Well, I can certainly get used to getting up here this early. Somebody's going to have to give me the high sign and remind me that we have other things yet to do, or I may just take all of that time. So somebody be aware of that. Imagine that you were in school and you started a new class. And typically when you start a new class, you go into the class at the first of the semester and the teacher explains to you the expectations and how things are going to go and what you'll be needing to do and the grading system and those kinds of things. And imagine that the teacher says to you that these are the things we're going to do in class. These are the tests that I'm going to give you. And we don't mess with grades in this class, but if you don't do well on the test I'll give you, we're going to break your leg. So how would you feel about that? Probably your first thought would be, I need to drop this class immediately. But if you couldn't drop it, how would you approach taking a test that if you didn't do well, if you didn't do it right, they're going to break your leg for it? Imagine that you go in to talk to a boss at a new job that you've just been hired to do. And the boss is telling you what is expected of you at that job, what you'll need to do. And at the end of that conversation where the boss tells you all the things that you will be expected to do, the boss says to you, just want you to know that somebody had this job before you and they didn't do it well. We didn't fire them, we killed them. How seriously would you take that job, right? We understand that when the consequences of not doing something well are very high or very bad, then we need to give utmost seriousness to making sure that we do that thing to the best of our ability. We're going to do something in a moment that some Christians who have gone before us did not do correctly. And for not doing it correctly, God struck them with physical weakness, physical sickness, and even physical death. What we're going to do in a few minutes is something that God obviously takes very seriously, as His punishment on some has shown. And therefore, it is something that we need to take seriously. How should we approach taking the Lord's Supper, not only to avoid serious consequences, but to get the most out of it? That's what we're talking about this morning. So what I'm referring to is in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where Paul has given them instruction on when small groups get together. This is the head covering passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Paul is giving them instruction on when they get together in small groups, not as a church, but in small groups. Sometimes women would pray or prophesy at those meetings, not in church, but in those meetings. And he talks about, gives them instruction, and he deals with that. But then in the second half of 1 Corinthians 11, he gives them instruction on taking the Lord's Supper, because many of them were not doing it correctly. And there were serious consequences for not having done it correctly. He says in 1 Corinthians 11 and in verse 29, he who eats and drinks the Lord, judgment to himself if he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep, which we know in the Bible is very often used for what? Death. Now, there are two ways to take this idea of their weakness, sickness, and death as a punishment for not taking the Lord's Supper correctly. One is to view it spiritually. I would imagine, I haven't taken a poll, but I would imagine that this is probably the majority view. I think it's probably the majority view. That when he says that because you're not taking the Lord's Supper correctly, a number of you are weak and sick and some are dead, most people, I think, take that spiritually. Because you're not taking the Lord's Supper correctly, you're spiritually weak, you're spiritually sick, and some of you are spiritually dead. You know that it's a very important Bible interpretation principle that when you read the Bible, you must take it literally unless there is a very compelling reason not to do so. When you read the Bible, you take it literally unless there's some reason that taking it literally is just not possible. I don't find that here. The other possibility is that when he says you're not taking the Lord's Supper correctly, and because of that, some of you are weak and sick and a number have died, I take that literally. I take that in a physical sense because I find no reason not to take it that way. I compare that with 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 5, where Paul says you have there a man among you who is committing this horrible sin. And you haven't done anything about it. And so he says, I on my part have decided to deliver such a one to Satan for what? For the destruction of his what? Flesh. Again, people take that spiritually. I find no reason to take it so. I believe that Paul is saying that this man needs, somebody needs to get his attention. And I'm going to deliver him to Satan so that physically he will suffer. To get his attention and come around. We see this in other passages. Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5 lied to the apostles. What was the punishment? Physical death. God killed them. We were reading this morning in Revelation chapter 2 where there is this female false teacher in one of the churches in Revelation. And they weren't doing anything about it. And so Jesus says, I will cast her on a bed of sickness, and I will strike her children with pestilence. It is not unusual for God to respond with physical punishment and suffering when people are not following his will. Now, granted, this is something I believe limited to the early church. So please understand what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that. This is something that God has determined that he's going to do throughout history. Although he could. What I'm saying to you is that it was part of the earliest days of the church. And why would he do it in the early days? Well, because when something is just getting started, sometimes you need to make sure that the ground rules are very clearly understood. Right? Sometimes when you're just getting started, those of you dealt with children, maybe you've coached or you've taught, and you've dealt with children or young people. When you're dealing with young people, it's very important to get the ground rules established right off the bat. And sometimes what does that take? Making an example out of somebody. You got to make sure we all understand what the ground rules are right off the bat so that we understand how serious it is that when you don't do what you're supposed to do, very serious consequences follow. So God is sending a message here. Whatever we believe about literal, spiritual, whatever, God is sending a message in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that we cannot miss. Taking the Lord's Supper is an issue of what level of seriousness would you say it is? How serious would you say it is? However you take that, this is a very serious issue. It's a big deal. How we do it. He says the one who doesn't do it correctly in verse 29 eats and drinks judgment to himself. He says that when you do not take the Lord's Supper correctly, you are guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. What does that mean? That means that when you do not have the right mindset about the Lord's Supper, you are as guilty as those who physically crucified the Lord. That's, you stand in that degree of guilt. Is that a big deal or not? Is taking the Lord's Supper serious or not? Is it something we need to get right or not? This is very serious. It's very serious. This is something we must get right. Not simply because we want to avoid the bad consequences, but there's a lot of blessing to be had in the Lord's Supper. And we want to be sure that we get it. We need to understand how serious this is. So let's talk a little bit about what the Lord's Supper is. Of course, we're talking about what we do typically we would have already have done it before I start preaching the way that we do it here, and there's no set system for this. We can do it in whatever order we want to do it. But typically, this is when we have the fruit of the vine, right? We have the bread, and we have someone come up here and talk to us about what we're doing. We read a passage, sing a song, have a prayer, and then we take the bread, and then we take the fruit of the vine, the grape juice, right? So that this is what we're talking about when we talk about the Lord's Supper. So what is it? When we're talking about the Lord's Supper, what exactly is it? At its most basic, at the fundamental level, the Lord's Supper is simply this. It is an act we perform to remember something that's already happened in the past. At its most basic, most fundamental. The Lord's Supper is an act that we perform now that reminds us of an event that has already happened, which is what? The crucifixion of Jesus. Okay, it's an act of remembrance. Sometimes we call it a memorial. It is an act of remembrance. We have these in our own culture, in American culture, right? We have moments of remembrance. We have things like Memorial Day, right? Memorial Day remembers, it's a time of remembrance for members of the military who have died in service to our country. That's what Memorial Day is for. We have Veterans Day. Veterans Day is different from Memorial Day. Veterans Day remembers all people who have served. So Memorial Day, we observe to remember those who have died in military service to our country. Veterans Day commemorates and remembers all who have served. And we celebrate these with all of the appropriate trappings, right? There's a lot of red, white, and blue. There's in media, TV, online, you'll see a lot of references to it. This is what it's for. This is what we're supposed to be doing. This is what we're remembering. This is what this day is about. But you know as well as I do that the vast majority of people on Memorial Day are not taking time to really reflect and remember those who have died in military service, are they? Most people on Memorial Day are doing what? Enjoying a day off. They're eating some hot dogs, maybe going to the pool, going to the beach. That's what most people are doing. We know that on Veterans Day, even though we're surrounded by red, white, and blue, and we're reminded about what it's about, that most people's minds are not on what that's really about. Their minds are elsewhere. The Lord's Supper is very often the same way, isn't it? The Lord's Supper is very often the same way. The Lord's Supper is a time that we pause and we do something to remember the death of Jesus, yet how often when we're doing it is our mind somewhere else? How often are we thinking about something else? And we've got all the trappings that we're supposed to have. We've had a song to do what? We always say it. To what? To prepare our minds for the Lord's Supper. And we have someone come up here and read a passage for what? To prepare our minds. And then we have, maybe they'll make some comments to prepare our minds. And we'll have two prayers to get our minds focused. And yet, what do we often find our minds doing? Going anywhere in the world except what they're supposed to be on. Wandering around or thinking about other things. Maybe not even making the real attempt to be where they're supposed to be. Is that serious? Is that a big deal? If we do not judge the body rightly, we're guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. If we don't do it right, the Bible says we are judged. So let me ask you a question. Do you think on Memorial Day, where we're supposed to be remembering, though most of us probably aren't, when we're supposed to be remembering those who have died in military service, do you think anybody is getting that right? Do you think anybody is getting Memorial Day right? Do you think anybody is thinking on Memorial Day about what they're supposed to be thinking about, those who have died in military service? Do you think anybody's thinking about that? I would imagine that the father that I witnessed at Arlington attending a funeral, the father who himself was dressed in his dress uniform, attending the funeral of his son who died in Afghanistan, who was standing in front of his son's coffin and saluting and speaking to his son, I would imagine he keeps Memorial Day the way it's supposed to be kept. That would be my guess. That when we're supposed to be thinking about those who have died in military service, I bet that's what he's thinking about. This is where his mind is. And I bet on Veterans Day, when we're supposed to be thinking about those who are serving and those who have served, I would imagine the wife who's home with the kids, whose husband is deployed and may not be back for a year, do you think her mind is where it's supposed to be on Veterans Day? The serviceman or servicewoman who has come back missing a leg or an arm or an eye, you imagine their minds are where they're supposed to be? I would imagine they are. So, well, what's the difference? What's the difference between that father attending his son's funeral, or the wife whose husband is deployed, or the veteran who's come back missing a leg? Why do you think their minds are on it when they're supposed to be? Simply because they know it personally, they know it, and they're living it. And when those days come along that are supposed to focus on it, they do. Why? Because they're living it. Because they know it. Because they're experiencing it every single day. Same's true of the Lord's Supper. The same thing is true when it comes to the Lord's Supper. When it comes to the Lord's Supper, whose mind will be on what it's supposed to be? The Christians who know it, the Christians who have studied it, the Christians who think about it, and the Christians who are living it. Their minds. Not that they won't sometimes have struggles, not that they won't sometimes be stressed or tired or worried, not that they sometimes mind, not that. But by and large, don't you imagine that if a person is a Christian whose mind is constantly in the Word, whose prayer is constantly in the name of Jesus who died for them, who themselves have taken up, not just learned about the cross, they've taken it up. Don't you imagine when it comes to the Lord's Supper, their minds will be where they're supposed to be? I would think so. I've read a lot about the military and warfare in my lifetime. It is something I find endlessly fascinating, and I read about it all the time. And I know, for a civilian, a little bit about it. But I would imagine that Neil and Eddie and John and Michelle and Chastity, I almost called you Cassidy for some reason. I don't know where in the world that came from. I would imagine that Ray, who comes from a military family, and others, Carol's in a military family. I would imagine that those who are military or in the military have seen combat, have been through basic, have been deployed, have watched loved ones be deployed, would say to me, "You don't know anything about it." And I would agree with that. Because there's reading about it and there's living it. There's learning about it and there's doing it. And it's one thing to take the Bible and to read about Jesus and the cross, and it's another thing to take your cross and go live it. That's something different, isn't it? That's different. And there's just a big difference between knowing something and living something. If you have taken your cross and follow Jesus, then when it comes time to think about Jesus on His cross, do you imagine that's going to mean a little bit more to you? I would imagine it would. So what we've seen constantly throughout this series on how to get the most out of church is is this. This is the biggest takeaway. This is the big idea. That in order to get the most out of church, how many hours a week? Right? How many hours a week are we here? 2 hours. 2 hours in church. That's it. How many hours in a week total? 168. If we're going to get the most out of this little bitty tiny slice of time that we spend in church, then we're going to have to be thinking it, reading it, living it, praying it, doing it for 166 hours outside of church. You can't just go out there and do your thing and then show up for 2 hours a week and it just be awesome. It just doesn't happen. Been watching a lot of basketball this weekend. This is, for a sports fan, the best weekend in the whole calendar. This is it. Basketball, wall to wall. Noon to midnight. It's fantastic. And it's amazing to me to watch these elite athletes go and play the game for 2 hours, to go and play at the highest possible level. It's unbelievable the things they can do, the skill that they have. It's amazing that anybody can just not do anything all day long, not do anything, not put in any work, in no practice, no film sessions, none of that, and just show up and play for 2 hours and be awesome. Isn't that amazing that you can do that? Well, you can't do that. You can't not work at it and then show up for a 2 hour game and be awesome. Can you? You know that professional athletes practice an average of 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. That may not sound like a lot, but you may never have seen a professional athlete work out either. About 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. Not to mention all of the work that goes into the nutrition, all of the work that goes into getting the sleep they need, all the work that goes into watching the film they have to watch, all the time that goes into getting the coaching that they need to get, all so they can do what? Show up for 2 hours and be awesome. You don't show up for 2 hours and be awesome without putting in the work away from that. And church is no different. Church is no different. If sometimes we show up to church and it's less than awesome, kind of lame, don't really get a lot out of it, not much going on, it's just not real good. Immediately we think the preacher must have been off, and he might have been. The song leader was off. The prayer leader's off. The Lord's Supper guy was off. Do we ever stop and think, what have I been doing all week to get me ready and prepared to really have a great time at church? A great time, I don't mean fun. I mean to get a lot out of it. This is what we've got to do away from it to get the most out of it. So when we're thinking about the Lord's Supper, what are we talking about? When we're taking the Lord's Supper, there are three things that we're thinking about when we take the Lord's Supper. There are three things that we think about when we take the Lord's Supper. Number one, the facts of His death. The facts of His death. Number two, the meaning of His death. So the facts of His death, what happened? The meaning of His death, what does it mean? The impact of His death, what does it mean to me? All right? So when we're taking the Lord's Supper, we're thinking about the facts of His death. We know all. He was arrested in the garden, and we know all that. All right? You know the facts of it already. You know that He was crucified, nailed through the wrists, not the hands, because the hands wouldn't support the weight of the body. You know He's nailed through the feet. You know a crucifixion victim dies from asphyxiation. You know that. You know, He was scourged beforehand, what that is, the cat of nine tails and the shredding of the back. You know the facts of it. You know that his legs weren't broken. You know that he was stabbed in the side. You know the facts of it. Do you know the rest of it? Do you know the meaning of it? If I said to you, why did Jesus die on the cross? We know the answer to that. Save us our sins, we go to heaven. We've known that since we were 3 years old. You know the meaning, but do you know the meaning of it? Do you really understand deeply the meaning of his death? You know words like redemption and justification and propitiation. You know what they mean. So sure, I know what they mean. Redemption, to buy. Justification, declare not guilty. Propitiation, appease anger. Of course I know all of that. But don't we sometimes throw out definitions without really getting what we're talking about? Ever do that? What is grace? Unmerited favor. What's a parable? Earthly story, the heavenly meaning. We can throw out definitions all day long. You know what that doesn't mean? That doesn't mean that you understand it. It doesn't mean that you understand it. A blind person could define the color blue, an intermediate color between green and violet. A blind person can define the color blue, but they can't understand it. They can't understand it. A psychopath could define the love, strong affection for another person, but they can't understand it. Just because you can define it doesn't mean you get it. What does it mean? Turn over to Romans chapter 3 and notice this. And I just want to ask you, this is just one example. Could you sit down and explain to a person who had no knowledge of Christianity, Romans chapter 3, 21 to 26? Could you sit down with a person who knew nothing about Jesus and explain Romans chapter 3, verses 21 to 26? Apart from the law, Romans 3, 21, apart from the law, the righteousness of God. What does that mean? The righteousness of God. What does that mean? Does it mean that God is righteous? Does it mean God makes you righteous? What does it mean? The righteousness of God has been manifested. What does that mean? How? How has it been manifested? What does that mean? Being witnessed by the law and the prophets. How was it witnessed? Where was it witnessed? Even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe. What does it mean to believe? What does that mean to believe? Mental assent, mental understanding, obedience, not obedient. What does it mean? For there is no distinction. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Is that the same thing? All have sinned and fall short of the glory. Is that the same thing? We have, and one is past, one's present. Is it the same thing? What does it mean? What does it mean to fall short of God's glory? How do you do that? Do you have God's glory? What does that mean? Being justified, what does that word mean? As a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly. How did he do that? Why did he do that? As a propitiation, what does that mean? Whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith. Whose faith? Your faith? My faith? Jesus' faith? The faith? What does it mean? This was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, he passed over the sins previously committed. Wait a minute, what? God did what? God just let stuff go? Just ignored it? Didn't deal with it? Verse 26, for the demonstration of his righteousness at the present time, so that, and here Paul's just going to be Paul, so that he would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. What does that mean? So he'd be just and the, what does it mean? Could you sit down with someone who had no knowledge of Jesus and go through that passage point by point and word for word and say, this is what it means? Do we understand what the death of Jesus means? We need to, because it is the most important thing in our lives, bar none. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, here's what Paul says. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that what we need to know about the Lord's Supper is not only the facts of it. He said you need to know the purpose of it. Look in verse 24. This is my body, which is what? This is my body which is for you. What does that mean? This is my body which is for you. What does that mean? It means that it is for our benefit. It's for us. We get the benefit. But it also means that it is in place of us. My body is given where your body should have been. Your body should have been on the cross. Your body should have been under the whip. Your body should have been nailed to wood. Your body should have been bleeding. Your body should have been suffocating. Your body should have been separated from God and your spirit because of your sin, so that you cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? That should have been Brandy, and it should have been Herb, and it should have been Jim. But what happened? Jesus said, I will take you off the cross, and I will put myself there instead. I will take that for you. The most horrific physical, mental, and emotional suffering a person could endure. So we didn't have to. That's what it means. And Paul says, or Jesus said, and Paul quotes, this is to bring us into a covenant with God. This is to bring us into a covenant with God. So I want to say something for a moment to those who lead at the Lord's Supper. Then we'll talk about those of us who take the Lord's Supper. So I just want to say this to those who are given the job sometimes of leading for the Lord's Supper. So just to give some thought, when you lead our minds in thinking about the Lord's Supper, not only to lead our minds in the facts of it, Matthew 26 is awesome, Isaiah 53 is awesome, 1 Corinthians 11 is awesome, not saying anything about using those passages, fantastic, should be used. But there are so many other passages in the Bible that talk about what the Lord's Supper means. And I would just suggest to you that if you are a person who leads us in taking the Lord's Supper, we need you to tell us not only what happened, we need for you to tell us why it matters to us. We need for you to tell us from Romans 8:32 that if God did not spare his own son, how much more will he freely give us all things? That one thing that the Lord's Supper says is, if God would kill his son for you, I think he can help you handle the job you have, or the test you have, or the sickness you have. Right? That's what that means. Philippians chapter 2 and verses 3 through 11. Says, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, that though he exists in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be held on to, but he emptied himself, took the form of a bondservant, became in appearance as a man, and died. And died. What does that mean? It means that he was humble, so you should be humble. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. That Jesus died for us, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God. See what I'm saying? There are passages that we seldom look at in the Bible that tell us, as those who are taking the Lord's Supper, not just what happened, it tells us why it matters to us. And we need for you, as a person leading our minds, to tell us, help us to understand what it means. So for those of us who are taking the Lord's Supper, as we're going to do in just a moment, those of us who are taking the Lord's Supper, he says we must avoid taking it in an unworthy manner. It's a phrase that's often been understood. Some people have refused to take the Lord's Supper because they say, I am not worthy to do so. So I'm not going to take it based on this verse. That's not what he says. He doesn't say that. He's not talking about your personal worthiness. He's talking about the way that you take it. And the way that we take it can be unworthy. How do we avoid that? He tells us in verse 28 by saying, we must examine ourselves. I believe he means by this, not an examination of our lives, so that this is an opportunity for us to think about how we're living, although that's cool. That's fine. I don't think that's what he's saying here. I think what he's saying here is, as we're preparing to take the Lord's Supper, Each and every one of us needs to be looking in our own minds and saying, are you thinking about what you're supposed to be thinking about? Are you thinking about the facts of his death? Are you thinking about the meaning of his death? Are you thinking about the personal impact of his death? And if you aren't, you might want to start. Because the consequences of not doing that are severe. Those people in Corinth, some of them, got sick and weak and died because they did not take the Lord's Supper correctly. For us, there's a change in that. For us, so they were weak and sick and died because they did not do it correctly. For us, so notice the change, for us, we don't do it correctly when we don't do it correctly. It's because we are weak and sick and possibly spiritually dead. See the difference? For us, when we don't take it correctly, it is out of spiritual weakness, out of spiritual sickness, and possibly out of spiritual death. And so at that point, the way that we take the Lord's Supper, if we don't do it the way that we're taught by Paul to do it, that becomes then a warning signal. It becomes a danger sign. If you find that you constantly or consistently take the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, that is a danger sign that there's something in your daily life that needs to be looked at and that needs to be fixed. And so this is a very gracious thing that God has given us, where we can get together once a week and we can do something that alerts us that there might be a problem. And so in just a moment, I'll get back up here and we'll close out the way we normally do with an invitation and an invitation song, prayer and all that as we normally do. But for now, with those things in mind, we'll turn over to Chuck, and Chuck will lead us at taking the Lord's Supper. Chuck.